As we continue our study this morning, we are looking at Numbers, the close of Numbers. We're also looking at the close of the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. So, bear that in mind, that as you approach the close of Numbers, you're also approaching the end of the 40 years of wandering. In fact, you can keep on with that idea in Deuteronomy. As you approach the end of Deuteronomy, we're still drawing to the very end of the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And then as you begin in the book of Joshua, the next book, we complete the very last of the years of wandering in the wilderness. So let's look now in Numbers 35. In Numbers 34, we looked at the borders of the land. The borders of the land. You all remember that? And we noticed that the borders are from the south coming out here over this way. In fact, let me get here. All right. So it would pretty well be coming out like this. And then the sea over here, the Mediterranean Sea. And then up here as far as Hamath. And then coming right down the Jordan Valley like that. So that Canaan is on the west side of the Jordan. So as we go into 35 now, we will be looking at the cities for the Levites and the cities of refuge. And we won't, again, we're not going to take a great deal of time to look at this, but we do want you to see. The Levites, remember, were not going to get a portion of their own, one solid portion of territory. They were going to be scattered throughout Israel. And it's interesting that if you look at, go back for just a minute here to Genesis 49. See, we're going back a pretty good bit there. All right, going back to Simeon and Levi in chapter 49, verse 5. Genesis 49 and verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Weapons of violence are on their swords. O my soul, come not thou into their counsel. In other words, don't follow their advice. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hocked an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. What are the next two lines? What does he say? Now, did you see that? I hope that makes an impression on you that Jacob, as he was dying, was setting forth the very things that we're going to see did come true with regard to Simeon and Levi. So here we find that Levi is not going to have their territory in one plot, but they're going to be given 48 cities. 48 cities that would be scattered up and down the land. So up and down the land, there would be cities on both sides. They would be given 48 cities. Now, of these cities, six of them were to be called cities of refuge. And so we're going to look now at the cities of refuge, even though the Bible itself does not give attention to specifically which ones these were. I'm going to go ahead and give you a look at that, okay? So starting down here in what would be Judah's territory, we have Hebron. Hebron was one of them. And then the next one was Shechem, up in the central part. And then the next one was Golan, no, Kedesh, up there in the very north. And then Golan, and that's the Golan that is famous today because it is the Golan Heights, a very elevated, mountainous region looking down on the Sea of Galilee. So, when When Golda Meir was, now some of you probably never heard of Golda Meir, but she was like the prime minister, the leader of Israel back during the, I don't remember if it was the 67 war, I guess it was the 67 war that they had, whatever. They've had a couple and they've kind of gotten lost in the past there to me. But she was negotiating with Henry Kissinger to determine whether she was going, you know, which part of this land that they had conquered they were going to be able to keep. And so she said, well, we're going to keep the Golan Heights. Well, why? Well, why? Well, I'm going to take you there. No, no, I can't, because as a representative of a government and blah, 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 I can't go there. So, okay, well, they got in the helicopter, and Golda Meir told the pilot, flies to the Golan Heights. So they took them to the Golan Heights anyway, and they landed, and she said, you see down there? That's why we've got to have the Golan Heights. In other words, the Syrians had done it, and they could any time place their gun emplacements up there on the Golan Heights, well up here, way high above, and just shell anything they wanted to down there. And so Henry Kissinger said, okay. So she was quite a forceful character, I take it. But that's the Golan Heights. And it wasn't just a mountain, but it's a whole area up here in that, you know, in that north, kind of the northeast there. Now the next one is down here called Ramoth, and it came to be known as Ramoth-Gilead because it was associated with Gilead. So Ramoth-Gilead, and listen. One of the reasons you need to make a note of these and begin to sort of fix these in your mind is because during Israelite history, you're going to read about, I'll use Ramoth-Gilead as an example. Over and over and over, we find the Israelites fighting with the Ammonites or somebody for control of Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab was fighting for control of Ramoth-Gilead. His son, Jehoram, was fighting for Ramoth-Gilead when he was killed. So it was a city of refuge, a very important city to the Israelites. So, and it was also a city that sat right there on the king's highway. And frankly, I don't know which one was of more importance to the Israelites, you know, as time went on, because control of the king's highway would give them, the taxes and tribute and things like that. It'd be lucrative. But I don't know. I have an idea that came to be more of a point, especially with men like Ahab and Jehoram and things like that. But Ramoth-Gilead was a city of refuge. And then Bezer. Yeah, Bezer. B-E-Z-E-R. Bezer is just one of those cities that we just about never hear of. It's unfamiliar. Of these cities, I would say that we're more familiar with Hebron and Shechem and Ramoth-Gilead. Probably those are the three that we're more familiar with than the others. But there were six scattered up and down the land like that. And in chapter 35, it makes the point, look in verse 6. 35, verse 6. And the cities which you shall give unto the Levites, they shall be the six cities of refuge which you shall give for the manslayer to flee unto, and besides them ye shall give 42 cities. So that the total of 48 included the six cities of refuge. So there were six cities of refuge plus 42 others scattered all up and down the land. And they were for the cities to be cities of refuge. And these cities would be given with the outlying areas, fields, stuff like that, although that didn't mean that they would have be able to go out and have big farms and everything like that, but they would have the city, and then they would have enough fields around the city they could feed their flocks and everything. But it wasn't comparable to a portion that a man might receive in another tribe. But they wouldn't have enough area there that they would be able to feed their flocks and things like that. And in the tribes that had, look down in verse 8, in the tribes that had a lot of land, they would take more cities. The tribes that had less land, they would take fewer cities. You know, that'd be fair, because they had more or less. Now, these six cities of refuge, the purpose of these cities, it applied both to the Israelite as well as the foreigner that dwelt in the land. If you were responsible for someone's death, now it might be that you had, there was evidence that you had animosity toward this person, and that you planned this, and that you deliberately killed the person. Or it might be that there was no evidence you had any animosity toward this person, that you did not plan anything. It was an accident or manslaughter, not deliberate murder. Well, the thing that would happen would be that it would sort of, I think, the way it would have worked out, it would have sort of depended on the situation. But you might choose, if you have been responsible for killing someone, whatever the circumstances, you would flee to a city of refuge. Now, when you got to the city of refuge, that would mean that nobody could come in there and just take you and kill you. But they would have a trial. And they would examine the facts and see whether you were indeed guilty of murder. And if you were, then you would be turned over to the manslayer. If you were not guilty of murder, then you were told, okay, you can stay in the city of refuge. However, you would have to stay in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest, whenever that would be. So, you know, if your time in the city of refuge was when the high priest was 98, you could say, I won't be here long. But he might be 35, and you could say, well, I might as well settle down here. This is going to be my home. But you couldn't leave. And if you did leave, then the manslayer had the right to catch you out and kill you. Now, it's an interesting thing as you look at this term, manslayer, as we will go through here. Look in verse 11. Then you shall appoint you, this is 35, Numbers 35, 11. Then you shall appoint you cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer that killeth any person unwittingly may flee thither. And the cities that shall be unto you for refuge from the avenger. Now it's the avenger that I have in mind, not the manslayer. It's the avenger. That's what I have in mind. That's a very interesting term. The avenger. The city shall be unto you for refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer die not until he stand before the congregation for judgment. See that? So then you'd have the trial. And the cities were scattered about so that wherever you were, it would not be a long distance to a city of refuge, any city of refuge, you know, you could get to. So then it gives the various situations, like in verse 16. If he smote him with an instrument of iron so that he died, he's a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. If he smote him with a stone in the hand whereby a man may die, and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he smote him with a weapon of wood in the hand whereby a man may die. In other words, If you took an instrument, whether it was a cutting instrument or a blunt instrument, but the point was that this was calculated, it was entirely likely that if you really whacked somebody good with that in the right spot, you'd kill him. In other words, that's what he's talking about, that a man may die, whereby a man may die. He's saying that if you do any act like that where it's likely that the man will die, then that means you knew what you were doing. And you deliberately took that and used it as a weapon. And so in those circumstances, he says, the murderer shall surely be put to death. And verse 19, the avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. Now when you look at that avenger, the avenger of blood in the original language, it means the next of kin. So that it is the same word that would be used when Boaz was checking if he was the one next in line to have the right to marry Ruth, and he finds out that there's one that is nearer of kin than he. That idea, the near of kin, the next of kin. So the avenger of blood here is just a translation in view of the fact that it was the next of kin who would be taking the responsibility to punish the one that slew his relative. Now, another thing, do you see how this provision would keep there from being a blood feud getting started here? There couldn't be a blood feud getting started here. And there couldn't be just a random killing and vengeance going on. No, there were these laws that were put in place to keep that from happening. So that if you were responsible for someone's death, I mean, can you put yourself in the place to know what would be the first thing you would want to do? Take off. You go and get in that city of refuge, because if it was an accident, you're innocent, okay, that will be shown. If it was deliberate, it's going to be shown. But you run to that place, especially if you're innocent. You run to that place so you will have that protection from the manslayer. And then the manslayer, the next of kin, will not be able to lay a hand on you unless you are shown to be guilty of murder. And then you will be turned over to the manslayer. But it's a control thing, you see. A matter of law. Not a matter of personal vengeance, but a matter of law. And so that's an interesting thing to note. And it gives the situation then in verses 22 through 28 where it was, it was an accident, so on. But look down in verse 28. Because he should have remained, okay, back in 25, let's read there. And the congregation shall deliver the manslayer out of the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge whither he was fled. And he shall dwell therein until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the border of his city of refuge, whither he fleeth, and the avenger of blood find him without the border of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood slay the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. That was part of the condition. Because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return into the land of his possession. So there was the law regarding the cities of refuge. But in this passage, in this chapter, there's another passage that I want us to read, because I believe that it has great significance, even today. Because following the flood, do you all remember how we designate Genesis 9? Yeah, that's right. It's the things immediately after the flood. And one of them was, he gave them meat to eat. And another one, capital punishment. And another one, the rainbow covenant. And another one, the sin of Ham. But the law of capital punishment was instituted. Now that was That was clear back before the law of Moses. That was after the flood was over. And it was a law given to Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Well, you know what that was? That was mankind. Because at that time, mankind consisted of eight people. So do you see how a general law given to these eight people would apply not only to them, but to everybody that descended from them? The points that God made there was that by the one that sheds the blood of a man, his blood is to be shed. And bear in mind that at that very time, what God was doing was he was making the point, okay, now I have given you the right to kill the beasts and eat the beasts. But your killing the beasts does not give you the right to what? Kill one another. So he makes a very great distinction between the idea of we may kill the animals for our food, we may not kill one another. And so he says, if one kills another, his blood is to be shed. And so that was the law of capital punishment. And the reason for it was to enhance and to uphold the sanctity of life. Because man was made in the image of God of all creatures. He was the one made in the image of God. And therefore God said, he is different. Man is different. You are not to kill one another as you kill the animals. So he instituted that law before in the law of Moses. Well, here in the law of Moses now, we're seeing the same principle incorporated all throughout the law of Moses. So look at the points that are made now in verses 29 through 34. Paul, could you read that for us? Now, do you see that he says, for the one that has murdered, that verse 31, take no ransom for the life of a murderer. So that means, don't you see, that means that the murderer could not say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll pay a fee. I'll pay a fee of money. I'll pay a fee of livestock. I'll pay a fee of property. The law was no fee. No ransom. That means that the death penalty could not be set aside. Steve?
That is pure justice.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And remember that the law provided for accident and things like that to be examined. And so it was not just, if somebody kills, you just kill them. No, that was controlled under the law here. That's what this is all about. But the point is that you could not set aside a conviction of murder. And you know, what? You know, the death penalty is not very effective today. Well, that's because it's not ever done. And if it is done, it's so many years later, then who remembers? I believe that the death penalty would be very effective if it were done in the right way. But whether it's done in the right way or not, this, I believe that the fact that you have this as a principle in the law, or in the time before Moses. You have it during the law of Moses, and then even in the New Testament, in passages like the servant of the government beareth not the sword in vain. So that and do you remember Paul making the point when he was on trial that if I have done wrong, I refuse not to die. In other words, I wouldn't accept the option not to die if I have done something worthy of death. So in all of the dispensations, the patriarchal, the Mosaic, Christian, since it was instituted, this law of capital punishment is something that has been a part of God's laws for mankind. Steve, did you? Other Steve.
Yeah, kind of included that, even though he may not have meant to kill the guy, he
Yes, yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. And Steve, did you notice what else it said there in that same verse about you can't take a ransom to set aside the murder? Remember? Notice what it said? He couldn't, what? He couldn't pay a ransom and get out of the city of refuge. So, you see, just like you're saying, he had to do the time that was there. So, look at that. Just make sure that you see that again. In verse 32, you shall take no ransom for him that is fled to his city of refuge, that he may come again to dwell in the land, until the death of the priest. So, you could not set it aside. You could not set aside the death penalty. You could not set aside the idea that, okay, you didn't murder the guy, but perhaps there was some contribution, maybe there was some negligence on your part, or maybe it was an accident, but still, you did it. So you stay here. You're not going to lose your life, but you're going to stay here. And so, I guess that would, one thing that would do, a couple of things that would do, is it would teach you that if I wanted, I better be careful about my temper. I better control my temper and not let my temper make me flash out and do something that would might injure somebody, and then they might die. And then where would I be? Or if I'm going to be careful working, what had I ought to do? I need to be careful with my work so that I don't be careless and kill somebody. You know, stuff like that. So these were laws that would have been beneficial to the land, and any land, if they were carried out. And the point he makes is that the blood polluteth the land. And that means when blood is shed and the blood of the killer is not shed, the land is polluted. Of course, it doesn't mean physically polluted. We understand that. But it means so far as men and their standing before God is concerned as a nation, and its standing before God is concerned. And we need to understand that we don't have any nation today which is the nation of God as a political nation. We, the children of God, are the nation of God, the kingdom of God, scattered all over the world. But nevertheless, throughout history, you're taking the prophets of the Old Testament as they dealt with Babylon and Moab and Ammon and Edom and Egypt and all these other countries. Those were not the kingdoms of God either. Nevertheless, you remember how God judged those countries for the evils that they did and for the correct things they did not do? He judged them. So I really believe that this is a principle that weighs heavily. And I think it weighs heavily today in the case of many, many countries, many, many nations of this world. Yes, Steve? you know, as you think about the, as you think about history, you think about how many infants, babies have been killed. And you think about our day, I think we would run a record for having the most infants killed, murdered. And when we get to heaven, I am of the opinion that by far the biggest number of people that will be there will be babies and children that were killed. Isn't that something to think about? But I am glad they will be there. They have their ticket punched straight to heaven. But it is a sad thing, nevertheless, to see that kind of thing happening. Well, let's move on. And in chapter 36 of Numbers, there's another kind of a follow-up. Remember in chapter 27, the matter of Zelophehad's daughters? And they ask, what if a man dies, leaving no son, can his daughters inherit? So Moses inquired of God, said yes. That's what God said, yes. Now here, the tribe of Manasseh, their leaders come, and they talk to him about this. And they said in verse 2, the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the children of Israel, and my Lord was commanded by Jehovah, or by the Lord, to give the inheritance of Zelophehad our brother unto his daughters. And if they be married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the children of Israel, then will their inheritance be taken away from the inheritance of our fathers, and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe whereunto they shall belong. So will it be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. That was the problem. And when the jubilee of the children of Israel shall be, then will their inheritance be added unto the inheritance of the tribe whereunto they shall belong. So will their inheritance be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. So that gradually the land would shift over and would shift over. So what the law says, look down in verse 8. Let's go back up in verse 6. This is the thing which the Lord doth command concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them be married to whom they think best. Only into the family of the tribe of their father shall they be married. Now that still gave them a lot of options.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can marry anyone you want as long as it is someone in Manasseh. Well, that still, like I say, that gave them a lot of options. But it would also keep the land from shifting then to another tribe. So in verse 7 he says, so shall no inheritance of the children of Israel remove from tribe to tribe. And so that was another thing that was ensured by the law, that the inheritances that would be given by lot would not be transferred or shifted to other tribes. So This concludes the study of the book of Numbers. And of course, I haven't been interested in just studying the book of Numbers. I've been studying the book of Numbers as it contributes to our understanding of the end of this period of wandering in the wilderness. Do you see that all of this stuff is in view of we're moving into the land? And we're going to be dividing it up. So these things are all important, necessary things for them to deal with. And as we go into the book of Deuteronomy, think of it as just about a seamless move into the book of Deuteronomy. Because this is also preparation. When you read the book of Deuteronomy, the impression you get is of a leader, Moses, preparing the people for the time when he will not be with them anymore. And he is wanting to prepare them for that time to come. I want you to look with me, please, at some things here. Just some general things about the book of Deuteronomy. First of all, I'll go ahead and tell you that deutero means two or second. So some people say, second law. I don't really know who gave it that. I didn't look that up, because I wasn't really that interested. That's not the name in Hebrew. The name in Hebrew would be, these are the words. It would just be the Hebrew for these are the words. First line there. But Deuteronomy, that name is given with the idea that this is a repetition of the law. It is the second law, second giving of the law, something like that. Well, Deuteronomy is not a repetition of the law. It is not a second giving of the law. What it is Moses reiterating what was said back at Mount Sinai in Leviticus and in Numbers. He reiterates that so that the people will have this on their mind. And one of the things he emphasizes over and over and over is that the secret to your dwelling in the land over there a long time is keep this law. And so he emphasizes that law to make them understand that thing. Okay? Now then, let's do a little looking here in the few minutes that we've got left. I would like for you to look in Deuteronomy 1. And we're going to be turning Deuteronomy to Joshua. So that we're going to be in that little range of scripture here. Look in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 3. Okay. So, Jeff, do you have that? Okay.
Now it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all the Lord had given him his commandments to them.
Now you see on the chart there? See how easy I make this? The 40th year, the 11th month, the first day. Now bear that in mind. Now we're going to go next to Joshua. So most of the time I put the passage up, but I didn't put it up this time. Joshua 5 and verse 10. Joshua 5 and verse 10. Okay, Steve Melton, if you're there, could you read that? Joshua 5:10. Okay, now, you remember that the Passover was in what month? All right, now look, we've got the 40th year, the 11th month. You see, we're coming to an end of that year, right? We're already in the first day of the 11th month. Now then, time passes by, and we have the children of Israel celebrating the Passover in the 41st year, the first month, the 14th day. Now, all I want you to do is just to look at this. And what we're going to do is we're going to go backwards. Because I've always found it easier to go backwards to establish what I'm going to show you. So at this point, we're just going to look at this, give you a little time to do the math. It had been about 2.5 months from the time that Moses had begun preaching the lessons of Deuteronomy, because it had been the 11th month, the 12th month, and then the first half of this month. Okay? Did everybody see that? So you've got the 11th month, the 12th month, and then the first half of the first month. So, all right. So just bear that in mind. 2.5 months. So, you know what that means? From the time Moses began preaching the sermons in Deuteronomy until that Passover was observed was 2.5 months. And that's the whole period there between the time Moses began and the Passover. Now then, look in Joshua 4:19. So just go back just a wee bit. might not even have to turn the page. 419. Okay, Jim, could you read that? All right, look now. See that? On the 10th day of the first month. Now, do you see how that relates to the 14th day? See, this is 4 days before the Passover. So do you get that? You're working with that in your mind now. This is 4 days before the Passover. So on the 10th day of the first month, the people encamped at Gilgal after crossing the Jordan. So they crossed the Jordan. Now then, look in chapter 3. Chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Okay, now Ted, you read that?
Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Acacia Grove and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they crossed over. So it was after 3 days that they all went to camp.
Okay. Oh, 3 days before, the Israelites had moved from Abel Shittim, or the Acacia Grove, as Ted read, to the Jordan in preparation for the crossing. All right, now then notice this. Joshua 2.22. Joshua 2.22. Jim Cooper. Now, these may have been concurrent 3 days. I don't think it matters that much, but I think it may have been concurrent periods of 3 days. In other words, it's the same 3 days. But it won't really make that much difference. But if it is, then you take from the 10th day, which was the last figure we had, go back 3 days. That would take us to the 7th day of the first month. Does everybody figure with me on that now? All right, now then, think about this. Look at the end, the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, the very last chapter in the book of Deuteronomy. And verse 8, 34:8. All right, Jimmy Johnson. All right, so you take 30 days back. That would take it back to the first week in December, so that you'd have the 4 weeks of November and 1 week in December, making a total of 5 weeks. This would leave approximately 5 weeks from the beginning of Moses' speeches until the end. Now, I like to do that because a lot of times people will hear the comment, well, the speeches of Deuteronomy cover about 5 weeks. Well, how do you know that? This is how you know that. See? So, even if this is not exactly precise, and I wouldn't care to argue that it is, it's close enough that we could, you're pretty well accurate in saying 5 weeks. So these sermons are given over a period of 5 weeks. And during that 5 weeks, I mean, how long would it take to read the book of Deuteronomy? It wouldn't take 5 weeks. So you've got some time here for the sermons to be preached. You've got some time for the people to hear them. You've got time for these to be written. And so there was time going on in here. Life was carrying on. But 5 weeks, and bear in mind that Moses was preparing the people, because we remember now, don't we, that he was not going to be able to go across. And we remember why, don't we? See, doesn't it add something when you know why and you know he's not, And you know he wants to, but you know he's accepted that. He's accepted that from the Lord. He doesn't one time say, that's not fair. Not one time does he say that or even hint at it. Because he knew it was fair. Oh man, as Moses knew what the Lord had done with him and his life, wow, what he had become. He could not feel that the Lord was stingy. Do you want to see that? You think Moses could have said, well, you're just being stingy after what God had done for Moses? And I think it's good to look at that last comment that is made. It's just such a, it makes the hair on my neck just sort of stand up. As I read 34:10-12, and there hath not arisen a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and in all the mighty hand and in all the great terror which Moses wrought in the sight of all Israel. Isn't that true? Well, there are things that go coursing through my mind, and one of them is the statement that Moses made himself back in Deuteronomy 8:18. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee. When has there been a prophet like unto Moses? Jesus. Oh, there were other great prophets, but there was not a prophet like Moses until Jesus. So, it's really interesting to think about that. Okay, we're going to stop now, and we'll take up here with Wednesday night.